The word of the day today is decarbonization. Look it up if you don't believe me. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, the 3rd of August. Good, as always, to have you here, everybody. One hates to undercut the President of the United States on what was, for him, a big news day, the rollout of the much-anticipated centerpiece to his plan to fight climate change, as you know. It envisions, in large measure, an overhaul of power plants, of what they burn, and of the broader electrical system as a whole while he's at it. But here's the thing. You talk to people in and around the power business, as our Scott Tong spends a lot of time doing, and you learn that this energy revolution of which the White House speaks is already happening. Not because of the EPA, but rather because of the MARKET. We just haven't really noticed, is all. Here's Scott.
As recently as 2012, Michael Liebreich at Bloomberg New Energy Finance had a blurry vision of what a clean energy future looked like. Today, it's in autofocus. He spoke by cell phone from Switzerland.
A few years ago, you could theorize about it, but as of the last probably 3 years, it's really become much, much clearer what the transition looks like.
There are lots of ingredients to this, but a biggie is cheap renewable power the EPA wants more of. In Nevada, one utility owned by Warren Buffett buys solar power for under 4 cents a kilowatt. That may be the cheapest electricity in America.
I think it's happened faster than certainly I anticipated.
Former utility executive Larry Riley is with Rosewood Energy Consulting. He compares the plunging cost of solar power to computer chips falling in prices. They got more powerful. Same for wind turbines.
They've made the towers taller, the blades longer. They've been able to get more efficiency, more kilowatt-hour generation from those resources.
The other market dynamic, natural gas from fracking, has also cratered in price, which pushes out coal. In fact, three major coal mining companies went bankrupt the last 2 years, and today brought number four. Michael Levy is an energy fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations.
Most of the big coal companies were near bankruptcy before this clean power plan was rolled out. This is not the thing that is primarily doing them in. They're being done in by cheap natural gas.
But can the power grid handle renewables? The sun doesn't always shine. Michael Liebreich at Bloomberg has heard the doubters. They feared brownouts if renewables made up more than 3% of the power supply. Then they got spooked at 5.
You know, we could do 5, we could do 7, but you know, if you get beyond 10%, the grid will fall over. And so it's gone. It's got 15%, 20%, Germany now, 29%.
It's proof to him the clean energy shakeout is well underway. To folks in the business, low-carbon electricity is no longer a high-tech, bionic man fantasy. We have the technology. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Speaking of technology, AT&T, as you might recall, bought the television service DirecTV earlier this year for a whole lot of money, almost $50 billion. Today, the first noticeable result of that deal, a new AT&T phone and television bundle priced at $200 a month with ramifications that may well go beyond just that company's subscribers. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports from New York on what's afoot.
Bundles that combine services like TV, internet, and phone are nothing new, but this package is different. Brett Sappington is director of research at Parks Associates, a consulting firm that focuses on digital technology.
The new AT&T bundle is unique in that it's a nationwide bundle.
That's the benefit of owning DirecTV, reaching customers without having to lay cable or fiber lines. This is just the latest in a series of big, expensive, and sometimes confusing bundles. Jim Nail, principal analyst at Forrester Research, thinks this deal could get AT&T some traction.
It looks like a very attractive kind of bundle, particularly by building in the mobile phone service into that.
Rolling mobile phones into the bundle is something your local cable company can't do. But AT&T's offer and the explosion in smartphone video may force cable companies to change course. Again, Brett Sappington.
One of the things that you may see is an increasing number of potential partnerships between television providers and mobile providers.
Bundling TV and phone could save consumers money and the headache of multiple bills. But there's a possible dark side, says NYU Business School economist Nicholas Economides.
It makes it hard for people to switch off a particular service. and that reduces competition in markets across the board.
Companies are less inclined to offer better prices or service when it's troublesome for you to choose another option. The fine print of AT&T's new package requires you to sign a 2-year contract to get the new DirecTV deal. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
The fine print on Wall Street today said, sell, baby, sell. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations out in Maui are over. Trade ministers from the 12 countries involved in the TPP have gone home pretty much empty-handed. Negotiators got 98% of the way there, one participant said, but 98% don't make 100, as we all know. Those talks have stretched on for 5 long years now, and that whole while, one of the major criticisms has been a lack of transparency about the way things have been kept behind closed doors. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson was out in Maui not too long ago. She brought back this glimpse into the process.
There are the people inside the negotiating rooms and the people outside. People in the know and people who'd like to know what's going on behind those closed doors.
I've adopted the Starbucks strategy.
James Love is a consumer advocate on intellectual property issues. While negotiators work in secured conference rooms at a Maui resort, home base for Love and most everyone else, is the long, snaking, open-air lobby with a waterfall in the middle and parrots in cages around the edges. Early in the week, Love targets countries' delegates when they line up for much-needed caffeine. He spots them by the ID badges they wear.
It's a little bit like the guy that hits on every woman in the bar. A lot of people don't like to do it because you feel like you're being a bit of a jerk, or it's a little annoying, but I'm willing to do that.
There are also a lot of calls back to Washington, D.C., lots of pounding away at laptops on patio tables with thatch umbrellas. Every spare plug is taken. The TPP has been billed as a blueprint for future trade agreements. So because of the late nature of these talks and the potential size and scope of the deal, people are desperate to know what's being decided so they can try to influence it. One afternoon, protesters line the beach and blow conch shells to try and get their concerns heard.
You try to talk to people, you try to talk to Japanese media because they always have the best information. Like, the Japanese media receive really good briefings from their delegation.
By the end of the week, Borju Kilic isn't sleeping. She's an attorney with Public Citizen and worried about how the TPP might affect access to medicines in poor countries. She estimates she's been to maybe a couple dozen rounds of negotiations.
We are now emotionally attached. If TPP ends, I will probably have a separation anxiety or something like that.
There are some groups who have better access to official information. Noel Campbell is chairman of the Australian Dairy Industry Council. Opening dairy markets in Japan and China has been a big issue in these negotiations, one of the toughest.
And we have daily briefings with all the advisors and also the negotiators.
But the rest of the day, he also waits in the lobby, working contacts from other countries and other commodity groups for intel.
You've got to take a bit of that tongue-in-cheek because you don't know whether what you're being fed is accurate or not. It is such a game, the whole thing, because one player needs to move to allow another player to move on particular issues.
On the final day of negotiations, the lobby is abuzz with speculation about whether or not the countries will announce a deal. Negotiators stay sealed in their conference rooms into the afternoon. Waiting in the lobby, a few people fall asleep in their chairs. One woman snores softly. And then, finally, word comes. No deal yet. And more work ahead. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
The avian flu that's been doing great damage to chicken and egg farms in some parts of this country has changed the economics of animal-based proteins just a little bit. The price of eggs almost doubled from May to June and has made them more expensive than chicken breasts for the first time on record. Ed Fryer is CEO of Ozark Mountain Poultry in Rogers, Arkansas. He raises and sells chicken meat, not eggs, but we call him from time to time to check in on all things chicken. Mr. Fryer, it's good to talk to you again, sir.
Oh, good to talk to you again, Kai.
Number one, I suppose, how's business?
Well, business is still doing well. It's not as good as it was earlier in the year, but it's still doing well. We're making money.
Which is always good. Why is it not as good as it was earlier in the year? Is poultry a seasonal thing?
Well, it is seasonal, but this is the time of the year we should be making money in terms of the seasonal factors. Fourth quarter of the year is the holiday season, so that's turkey and ham season. So the fourth quarter is normally not good for us. The first quarter is usually pretty good, but second and third quarters are normally your best quarters. But we've been hit by a couple of factors this year. One is the bird flu.
Yeah.
That avian influenza that's out there has really driven down dark meat prices. They're the leg quarters, the drums, thighs, that sort of thing. But the dark meat's it's less than half of what it was a year ago. Plus, if you look at the competing meats, beef is still very high, but pork has come down quite a bit. I think the pork guys finally got their hands around that PED virus that they had to deal with last year.
Yeah, they had trouble, intestinal trouble, shall we say, those pigs.
Yes, yes, they did.
Let me ask you something. I was looking at the Ozark Mountain Poultry website before I came in here, just to refresh my memory.
Yeah,
you've been in business 15 years now, right?
Yes.
Why did you go into the poultry business?
A couple of reasons. One, my last name is Fryer, and two, I used to be a professor at the University of Arkansas. Grain marketing, poultry marketing, and then hedging or price risk management were my areas of specialization. And then, plus, I've always enjoyed business. So, one day I just woke up and said, "Hey, it's time to do something different."
Is it what you thought it would be? Being in the poultry business, being in the chicken business?
It's actually much better than I thought it would be. Being a tenured professor at a university, at a major university, is a fantastic job. There's very, very few jobs that are any better than that. But I really like the private sector. Huh. Love creating value for our customers and creating opportunities for employees. And I have a chance to do that every day here.
Getting back to the matter at hand, how confident are you that you're going to be able to bounce back from this little dip you seem to be having when you're supposed to be making money?
The dip right now is it's a dip, but it's a little dip. As I look out for the rest of this year, I don't think things will get a whole lot better for the rest of this year. And as I look into next year, if I take avian influenza off the table, that's a real random variable. But if the rest of the industry just kind of follows its normal course, I think next year will be a pretty tough year for the industry.
That's not so good.
No, that's not so good. But, I mean, it's part of the chicken business.
Yeah, I suppose. Ed Fryer, CEO and founder of Ozark Mountain Poultry in Rogers, Arkansas. Mr. Fryer, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thanks, Guy.
Coming up.
I joke around and I say it's because how stupid we were, why this company worked.
Turns out you don't have to know anything about flowers to start a flower company. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 91 points today, 0.5%, closed at 17,598. The NASDAQ off 12 points, 0.25%, ended things at a neatly palindromic 5115. The S&P 500 down 5 points, again about 0.25%, finished at 2,098. Falling oil prices continue to hit energy companies. Chevron off 3.25%. ExxonMobil drilled 1.4% lower today. Results, corporate results also moved prices. Tyson Foods slipped 9.9% today after cutting its earnings outlook for the year. The maker of Jimmy Dean breakfast sausages blamed conditions in the beef market, including high cattle costs, for its troubles, which is, if you think back to what Mr. Fryer said, good news for chicken guys. Michael Kors swung down 7.8% after analysts at J.P. Morgan cut the price target on the handbag maker stock. I think they make much more than just that, though, right? Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.14%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on factory orders for June. President Obama is scheduled to meet with United Nations Secretary Ban Ki-moon at the White House. And let's celebrate bread and everything you can stack between two slices. August is National Sandwich Month. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Fans of MMA, mixed martial arts, know better than to blink when American fighter Ronda Rousey is in the ring. Last night, in one of her lengthier bouts of late, she finished off Brazilian challenger Betch Correa in 34 seconds. The fight down in Rio de Janeiro was broadcast on pay-per-view, a testament to MMA's rising popularity, even if Rousey's fights are over almost before they start. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has that story.
Ronda Rousey is a lot of things. She's the women's bantamweight champion in the Ultimate Fighting Championship. That's the company that organizes and promotes mixed martial arts events. She's an Olympic bronze medalist in judo. She's dabbled in modeling and acting. But merciful? She's not.
So I turned around to her after I knocked her out and I said, "Don't cry."
That's Rousey talking about the opponent she trounced over the weekend in half a minute. If that seems short, it's actually twice as long as two of her recent fights.
It's fast. It's almost played almost in a video game mentality.
Joe Favorito is a sports marketing professor at Columbia University. He says mixed martial arts fans are different from fans of other fighting sports, like boxing. He says they're younger and kind of ADD.
It's something that really appeals to a younger demo who may not like to sit at a baseball game for 2 or 3 hours. They like watching the quickness of UFC fights, and they could be over literally in seconds sometimes.
You might expect that would be a problem for the pay-per-view industry, which charges fans around $60 a crack to watch Rousey. But Stanford University economist Ali Yurigoglu says the quick knockouts can also be a selling point. Yurigoglu says that was what made boxer Mike Tyson so popular in his day.
Yeah, you might think, like, well, if it's really short, you're not getting your money's worth, but I think people get it in the excitement rather than the time.
Yurigoglu says fans might actually be more inclined to watch Rousey on pay-per-view to see how quickly she dispenses with her opponents. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Two big government health programs, Medicaid for low-income Americans and Medicare for seniors, turn 50 years old this year. A key part of Medicare, though, the Part D prescription drug benefit, went into effect less than 10 years ago. The law that established that benefit specifically prevented Medicare from directly negotiating the prices for those prescription drugs with the companies that make them. The Obama administration and some members of Congress want to change that, but perhaps not surprisingly, drug companies say things are just fine the way they are. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explores that debate from Washington.
At Neighborhood Pharmacy in Washington, D.C., pharmacist tech Saprice Barrett says about 30 to 40% of her clients use Medicare for their prescriptions.
And you can see them, like, you really can tell they're juggling the medication, trying to figure out what they need and don't need.
Barrett says Medicare premiums are pretty low and the copay's only a couple of bucks. But the independent pharmacy loses thousands of dollars a year trying to help bridge the gap when people can't afford their medicine.
Because we do try to help. We really do. But, hey, you don't know what to do.
Some advocates say those premiums could be lower and Medicare much more efficient if the agency could negotiate directly with drug companies. Currently, the insurance plans providing Medicare in different places are the ones negotiating. Dan Adcock is with the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare.
Because these plans are so divided up into all these different fiefdoms, they're not getting the type of discounts on drugs they would be getting if they were using the entire Medicare population.
Adcock makes the comparison with the Veterans Administration and Medicaid, which negotiate for all of their members at once. The Congressional Budget Office says Medicaid pays 27 to 38% less than Medicare for the most commonly used drugs.
The reality is there is robust negotiation that already happens in Medicare.
That's Lori Riley. She's with the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, the drug industry's main lobbying group. Riley points out Medicaid and the VA have fewer prescription choices available in their programs than Medicare. Plus, she says the individual providers are pretty good at haggling for drug prices.
These are purchasers that negotiate on behalf of tens of millions of people, and they're able to achieve significant savings.
But supporters of change have this number, $116 billion. That's the CBO estimate for how much Medicare could save over 10 years if it negotiated drug prices and rebates the way Medicaid does. Still, even if Medicare's negotiating power is changed, CBO says the savings would eventually disappear. Drug companies would raise the prices of new drugs to compensate. To Saprice Barrett, filling prescriptions at Neighborhood Pharmacy, every extra penny spent at the federal level eventually trickles down to extra costs for her customers.
I don't care how you look at it. At some point, somebody going to take the loss.
Some members of Congress have introduced a bill to give Medicare direct negotiating power, but it's unlikely to move forward this session. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
This has happened to you, right? You've ordered flowers for one occasion or another using one of those floral wire services like 1-800-Flowers or FTD maybe, and the flowers either came late or they looked nothing like the picture or something else wasn't quite right. Until just a couple of years ago, local florists or one of those wire services were pretty much your only option. But there is a startup out in Santa Monica, though, here in Southern California, that is trying to change that. Bloom Nation, it's called, and it's a little bit like Etsy. It's a web-based platform for florists to connect with customers and vice versa, and it is doing all it can to disrupt the nearly $30 billion a year floral industry. CEO Farbode Shiraka showed us around not too long ago as part of our coverage of the Los Angeles tech sector that has come to be known as Silicon Beach.
Most important thing, you got to have one of these.
Well, I'll tell you, yeah, the elevator door opens, you see the ping pong table, and you literally, you're like, I'm in a startup.
Yep, it's our source of sanity over there, so.
What does this company do?
So Bloom Nation is the first and largest marketplace for artisan local florists. Instead of using like 1-800-Flowers or any other broker to go and order your flowers and spend a lot of money in commissions and junk fees, you're able to go on bloomnation.com and order directly from local artisan florists nearby the recipient.
How'd you do the market research? I mean, how'd you figure out that this was the place that was ripe for disruption, right? Because that's what you're doing.
Yeah, it was an interesting discovery. You know, we knew it on the consumer side, right? Yeah. I order flowers, they look crappy. On top of that, if you go to these flower shops, which we did, the most important thing is we talked to the user, we talked to the florist. Every single one was frustrated with the services as well. So it wasn't a case of just the consumers being frustrated. The florists themselves were just as angry. And I thought, that doesn't make sense where the two most important people are frustrated in the transaction and the middleman is making all the money. There should be something that needs to be changed here. And then we spent a lot of time talking to the florist. That was our number one thing. And that's I think, what made us successful is we didn't come with a sense of, I know what to do. It was more, tell us what your problems are, and I'll create a solution.
What was step one? I mean, three guys straight out of college, no tech, no floral experience. What do you do?
So it was for us, it was a blessing that we didn't know anything about the floral industry. So I joke around and I say it's because how stupid we were, why this company worked.
You're not the first person who's told me that. You're not the first entrepreneur, actually.
Yeah. So we were able to look at solutions as if anything was possible, and that allows us to pick the best solutions.
Was there a moment when you knew you were going to make it, or are you not there yet?
I think it's the fundamental thing about an entrepreneur. One day you think this is going to be the biggest idea in the world. The next day you might think, like, are we going to make it? And so that's the roller coaster you live through, to be just completely candid. Not every day is the same. And so some days you don't feel like you're as confident. You don't know what's going to happen. The next day you might feel like, you know, you're already a millionaire.
Why are you guys down here instead of much closer to Berkeley, where you went to school, and Silicon Valley, where everybody is?
The three of us are Angelenos. So this is where our family is. This is where our friends are. This is where our heart is. And it happened to be that Silicon Beach has become an amazing place to start a tech company.
Do you feel that around here? I mean, do you feel the whole Silicon Beach thing?
Yeah, it's incredible how much support there is. And in fact, we go to San Francisco all the time, and we talk with big tech companies up there, and all the VCs are up there. It doesn't have the same kind of like camaraderie and support that LA has. LA has this feeling that you can help each other. It's not competitive. We're trying to make a name for ourselves here as a community. So I don't get that sense that I do when I'm up in the Bay Area.
I wonder if as the companies that are down here get bigger and richer and more influential, whether you're going to stop being such buddy buddies.
I'm sure. Yeah. It's natural. Yeah. But I love it right now. And I love the fact that we are pioneering the beginning days of Silicon Beach versus having to be a small fish in a big pond over in San Francisco.
Prabodh Sharaka, he is the CEO of Bloom Nation. All of our Silicon Beach stories are, of course, on our website. It's marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, in which the newspaper of record explains why women are more often cold in office buildings than are men. The New York Times reports on a study out today in the journal Nature Climate Change that says most office buildings set their temperatures based on a formula from decades ago, apparently, that uses the metabolic rate of a 40-year-old man weighing about 154 pounds as a baseline. Women are generally smaller with more body fat, so they don't generate as much heat. I commend that article to your attention if this is an issue for you. It is, come to think of it, a little chilly in the studio today. All right, we're out of here. The Dow off 91 points, about 0.5%. The NASDAQ down 12 points, 0.25%. The S&P 500 off 5 points, also 0.25%. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Mukta Mohan, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We are back tomorrow. Of course, we'll see you then. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.